Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. We have a very special interview today. Most of these aren't interviews. Let me just put it that way. In podcasting, there's kind of the Rogan-esque conversation, and there's like the Tim Ferriss interview. And it doesn't mean Tim doesn't have great interjections, but one is more ask questions, receive answers, and one is more shoot the shit and see where it goes. I think both are awesome. And even though I lean a little bit more towards interview, I do get on rants for damn sure. When I get inspired to say some shit or something lights me up inside, I'll definitely grab some mic time. This podcast today is for sure more interview style. And the reason for that was we didn't have a ton of time, but I realized the person I was sitting across from could hands down break this down in the amount of time that we had. And so while this is the return of Dr. Mark Gaffney, it is the introduction of David J. Temple. David J. Temple is a pseudonym created for enabling ongoing collaborative authorship at the Center for World Philosophy and Religion. The two primary authors behind David J. Temple are Mark Gaffney and Zach Stein. For different projects, specific writers will be named as part of the collaboration. In this volume, Ken Wilber joins Dr. Gaffney and Dr. Stein. So no short list here of it. It is a short list, but so needless to say, if you've never heard of Ken Wilber, Dr. Zach Stein, or Dr. Mark Gaffney, you're in for a treat. And I interviewed Dr. Mark Gaffney. We got 4 in the tank, 5 in the tank that we've done for the 12 Faces of Eros. Two or three of which have been on the Faces of Eros. The first two, of course, cover the main logistics and the nomenclature of what we're speaking about. This book is entirely different. And of course, those other episodes are really expanding upon and helping us dive deeper into a book called A Return to Eros by Mark Gaffney and Christina Kincaid. That's linked in the show notes. This is a brand new book that just came out. It's 42 propositions on cosmo-erotic humanism, the metacrisis, and the world to come. And it's a short one here, but Mark really lays down the foundation for why this is critical to our thinking and our understanding. If we don't create a new story yesterday, if we don't create a new story right this second about why we're here, we will lose our humanity. And I'm not a doomer. I don't think that, everything's going to go up in nukes. I don't think that the lights are going to turn out even though it's a damn strong possibility. I also don't think that AI is going to take us over and we're going to have a full merger and the Rogan, everyone reaches this point on a planet and they create something that's super intelligent and it blasts right by you. And I've read Super Intelligence by Nick Bostrom, which does pose a lot of concerns. I'm not saying that's not a valid concern, but I think the most valid of all concerns, as Mark explains it, is we lose our humanity. And this is what I get about, this is what I'm talking about with World Economic Forum type stuff, with Yuval Noah Harari and transhumanism. I think that is far, far more likely the death of our humanity than the death of humanity itself. But both are concerns, they're valid concerns. And both can be addressed if we rewrite and re-understand what it means to be a human. What it means to be on the planet, how does source work? How does consciousness work? And you pick your fucking poison for wordage. You don't have to get obsessed over the word God and all that other stuff. First principles and first values is a way to decode what it means to be alive. It's a way to give meaning and purpose behind everything we do, and it's a way to see the navigational tools inside of the GPS that's guiding us. Super important. To say that it's important is a huge fucking understatement. When I read a book, I do little page fold overs. I don't necessarily highlight because I don't want, if someone else reads it, I don't want them to think this is the only important part. Some other piece, like my wife or my son might read this, or my daughter eventually. But I'll fold over on the page where I know there's something that hits me and I'll look at that page. It's damn near every other page of this book that I have folded over. I mean, this thing is loaded. It's a small book, but it is loaded with spiritual gems. It is loaded with important information. And the thing that I love about Dr. Mark Gaffney, if you've been listening to him so far, is he doesn't beat around the bush with the shitty parts of the world. He doesn't beat around the bush with the negative thinking that has gotten us into this wormhole or rabbit hole, if you're paying attention. It's not a right versus left thing. It's not a Tucker Carlson thing. It's not they're coming after, what's that damn British guy's name? That's super funny, the comedian. I can only remember Aldous Snow from one of his characters when they smoked the Jeffrey. Y'all know what I'm talking about. The Jeffrey Smoker. You know, it's not about any one of these particular people, and it's about all of it. And it's about all the people too who aren't in the fight, quote unquote. You know, how many times have I been told, what do I have to worry about surveillance for if I'm a good person? What do I have to worry about cameras in my home if I'm a good person? I don't have nothing to hide. I have nothing to hide for Google to look into all my emails. That's not the point. And eventually you do have something to hide if what you do now magically becomes illegal overnight. Like having more than 8 people at your house magically became illegal overnight in much of the world. And I put tape over my Ring system and said, fuck that. We're going to have 12 people in this house day after day and no one got sick magically, right? So we don't need to rehearse the last 4 years and go back over that. But at the same time, it's really hard to forget. And it shouldn't be something we forget. It should be something we know that there is a playbook at play. And if we continue to allow things to happen to us and not wake up from it and learn from our experiences, that there is more to come. A lot more to come. That COVID is a walk in the park, a taste test, and the main course is well on its way. So please, from the bottom of my heart, check this book out by David J. Temple, which is really Dr. Zach Stein, Dr. Mark Gaffney, and of course, Ken Wilber, who has a laundry list of fucking dope books that he's already written, one of the world's greatest thinkers. And you know, I've taken a deeper dive into his work because of Paul Check. Paul Check has a section. If Paul Check has a section of one person in his library, that person has carved a space for themselves as one of the world's leading thinkers. Ken Wilber has done that. First principles and first values, we will link to it in the show notes. And this is a phenomenal breakdown of that. Most likely, we're going to have to take a look back through here again. This is the first of a series of books. So you're going to want to jump on this one. Just like we did the first two episodes on Eros that didn't cover the phases of Eros, but covered the totality of it. First principles and first values is your foundation layer to grabbing everything else these guys are going to come up with. So do not miss this one. Pick it up now. It is very easy to read. It's not out there. It's in here. And it's going to make sense to you from the first time you open it. All right. Love Dr. Mark Gaffney. And so thrilled that I got to help promote this book. Really just want his message to go as far and wide as possible. So share this with anybody that listens to podcasts, and hopefully they dig it and like it and share it with more people. And we just continue to spread the good flame. Also support this show by supporting our sponsors. They make this show fiscally possible. Today's episode is brought to you by HVMN. That's ketone.com/KKP is the cool little site they gave me. You can save 30% off your first subscription order of Ketone IQ at ketone.com/KKP. All right, what is Ketone IQ? Ketone IQ is one of the best ketone products on the planet. And I've talked at length about ketogenic diets. I've talked at length about the benefits of fasting. I've talked at length with some of the best doctors and leading advocates in the world, like Dr. Dominic D'Agostino and many others that prove that there is a lot of benefit to the body. If not permanently, but at least periodically, we reset our metabolic function and go into a state of withholding. Either withholding carbohydrates and restricting there, or withholding calories, or restricting all food altogether. This is a profound benefit. There's a great book called The Complete Guide to Fasting by Dr. Jason Fung that really covers this. At the end of the day, what is that doing? It's creating cellular autophagy, it's recycling things, and it's allowing our body to create ketones. Ketones are an incredible fuel source for the body. There's no metabolic waste from ketones that are converted to ATP from the mitochondria. It's a clean fuel. It's a super clean fuel. And it's such a clean energy boost that it's kind of hard to understand if you've never been in ketosis or never had ketones. But it's without sugar, it's without caffeine, and trust me, these things all stack together well. If you've got a competition coming up, have some carbs with some ketones and some caffeine. Do whatever's necessary to get yourself the most optimal. But for a lot of people, we don't want more caffeine. I'm not trying to go to bed jittery and figure out, oh shit, man, I had a drink at 3:30 in the afternoon. That's what did it. Right? I don't want that. I can have Ketone IQ at any time of day. I can even have it before bed and I'm still going to be able to sleep at night. This is really, really an awesome thing to use. I use it before workouts, including glycolytic workouts. Now, many would argue if you're training for strength sports or glycogen-based high-intensity interval training that it's not going to help, but ketones do help because they help the brain. Anytime you give the central governor more energy, you potentiate yourself to have a better workout. In addition to that, if the workout's longer, when I tell the story of when Tim Kennedy and I were sparring a while ago, I was gassed in the beginning because I had fasted before the workout. It was a morning workout. I was gassed. And somehow at the end of the hour, I had all the energy in the world returned to me because the ketone was in me from Ketone IQ. So I love using this pre-workout. There's many uses. I love using this before podcasts, and I sure as hell love using this for long days. If I've got a long, big schedule stacked in front of me, and as long as I have Ketone IQ, I know I can get through that. And yes, I'll still start with morning coffee. I'll still start with other things that help with that. But ketones are really the driving factor that give me authentic, real energy. It's not a simulated energy. It's not a stimulant. It's actual energy that my brain and body can use. Love this stuff. These guys work with top Olympic athletes like Des Linden to Michael Andrews to Ironman world champion Sam Laidlow. They just launched a supplement and research partnership with Team Visma Lease a Bike, top pro cycling team in the world, winning the last two Tour de France in 2023 and 2022 and swept all three Grand Tours this past year. You can find Ketone IQ in your local Sprouts nationwide. Love Sprouts, by the way. It's a side note. I used to get all my shit from Sprouts back in the day. So, I mean, I love this product. I love what it does for us. And I love the fact, you know, both the founders of these guys I've had on the podcast as well years back, they're dialed into optimization. These are people who live optimization the same way I did when I was director of human optimization at Onnit. It's what they breathe. It's what they eat. They sleep. And this is what they dream about. And they really have put together an amazing product. They have shots that you can get. The shots are a little bit more expensive, but what's cool about those is you can take a ready to drink shot with you in your bag, a couple of them. I usually have a couple of them on me. One's in a fanny pack, one's in a backpack. You can get the bottles, which are a little cheaper, and the bottles are a little bit more potent, let's say. There's a taste to it that takes some adjusting to. But I can assure you, the second you feel this, you're going to understand the why and you're not going to give a shit about the taste. And these guys have improved the taste a ton. You can save 30% off your first subscription order of Ketone IQ, and you're going to want to subscribe to this at ketone.com/KKP. That's KETONE.com/KKP. Give these guys a shout. We love them deeply, and I'm so happy they're back on the podcast. We're also brought to you today by a longtime sponsor, paleovalley.com. Remember to use code Kyle, that's K-Y-L-E, for 15% off everything in the store. These guys make the best bone broth protein powder on the planet. It's not processed with high heat. It's not extracted with harmful chemicals. It is 100% grass-fed and finished. Their cows are guaranteed to have never been fed on grains. And since the term grass-fed is unregulated, large collagen manufacturers are using this claim as well as pasture raised when actuality, the animals are finished in a feedlot where they are fed GMO grains. These cows are never given antibiotics, steroids, or hormones, and it's made from bones, not hides. This is a very important one. Most companies use the hides because it is cheaper. When collagen is sourced from the animal's skin, we miss out on all the extra nutrients and restorative benefits of the bones. People don't make hide broth, they make bone broth. So if you want a protein powder that's got it all, you want Paleo Valley's bone broth protein powder. It's 100% pure with no fillers, no flow agents, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, dairy-free, non-GMO, smell and flavor-free if you're going to go with the flavorless. And I love going with flavorless if I'm making desserts or if we're throwing it into smoothies with some yogurt and kefir and other goodies. But their chocolate flavor is what the kids love the most. And that's what we'll do, some raw milk. We got the A2A2 farm just down south of us. We get a gallon of raw milk, warm up a little bit, throw in a scoop of that and whisk it with a hand whisker. And it is the best hot chocolate your kids will ever have. Now they're getting loads of good nutrients from the raw milk and they're getting even more loads from this phenomenal bone broth protein. It's also a phenomenal sleep hack. If you don't want your kids taking melatonin, and it's quite likely they shouldn't, or some other sleep supplement, if you give them bone broth protein before bed, this is a high level of glycine. It's one of the amino acids that is a precursor to GABA, and it helps knock us out. You get 3 grams or higher, and some sleep supplements, many sleep supplements, have 3 grams of glycine in it just because other people know this. But if you get the bone broth protein before bed, you're going to get that. And so it's a great way to wind down the kids before sleep. That tastes phenomenal. They'll never even think they're taking a supplement that's designed to help them go to sleep. And so much can be said for the benefits of collagen. It eases arthritis symptoms and supports joint health, improves skin health and reduces the appearance of wrinkles, increases hair growth, can help increase bone density. That's a big one. Aids in blood sugar regulation. That's a massive one for the whole planet, especially us Americans. Helps prevent heart disease, supports gut health, helps build muscle mass and boost metabolism. That's great for all the athletes out there. Reduces the appearance of cellulite and promotes better sleep. We got to check this out. This is one of my favorite supplements on earth. It is a go-to that's in large supply in my pantry. We never run low on this stuff. Go to paleovalley.com. That's paleovalley.com and use code KYLE for 15% off. That's Kyle for 15% off. We're also brought to you today by another super long-term sponsor, Lucy.co. That's L-U-C-Y.co. Remember to use code KKP at checkout for 20% off. These guys are awesome. This is made for your nicotine routine and delivered straight to your door. 100% pure nicotine, always tobacco-free. Choose your form, pouches, breakers, or gum. Choose your strength, 2 milligram to 12 milligram. 2 milligrams is suitable for someone who uses nicotine infrequently. 4 to 8 is more likely to satisfy you if you have an everyday nicotine routine. And 12 milligram might be for you if you've been underwhelmed by the effects of other nicotine pouches. 12 milligrams might be for you if you've been working with nicotine for some time as well, like I have. I definitely like the heavier strength. Save yourself from the weekly gas station stop and sign up for a monthly subscription. You're going to save 15% automatic for that. No commitment. Cancel anytime. So Lucy Breakers is the new product they have. It's nicotine pouches with a tiny flavor capsule inside with liquid flavor that saturates the pouch before it's even in use. You just break it with your teeth, get it situated, and boom, instant nicotine release when you need it. A lot of people like that. I prefer just to throw in the old pouch and just wait for that guy to get saturated and start to work its magic. I've spoken at length about the benefits of nicotine on this podcast before, but in short, it is going to fit in the same receptors as acetylcholine, which is one of the main purposes behind all of nootropics. An entire industry was created to help your body create more acetylcholine when nature itself came up with something that fits in the exact receptor we're trying to work on. And what that means is better cognitive function, better memory, better language recall, you name it. If you're trying to learn or study or doing anything, I'm not working about kids, I'm talking about adults, we all should be studying still. That's plain and simple. If you made it out of college like I did and said, I'm never going to read a book again, hopefully a podcast like this have changed your mind, because my life has been changed through reading, and I've read far more fucking books than I ever did in college and before that, post-academic career. And with that, nicotine is a phenomenal accoutrement to reading and learning, because it's going to help my body store the information, my body and brain store the information that's necessary to be able to recall that. And as you know, as a podcaster, it's pretty important that I can recall these things. Go to lucy.co, that's L-U-C-Y.co, and use code KKP at checkout for 20% off. Level up your nicotine routine with Lucy. Go to lucy.co/KKP and use promo code KKP to get 20% off your first order. Lucy offers free shipping and has a 30-day refund policy if you change your mind. That's lucy.co and use KKP to get 20% off and always free shipping. And now you must read the below exactly as written. And here comes the fine print. Lucy products are only for adults of legal age, and every order is age verified. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Last but not least, we're talking about the homies at happyhippo.com/KKP. Use code KKP for 15% off everything in their entire glorious store. Happy Hippo Kratom is one of the best products on the planet, because if you like the powders like me, it's just powder. It's just the substrate. There's nothing else in there. And something people haven't really talked about is one of the benefits is this indigestible fiber. Now, you can go back and forth from the carnivore guys to not, but if you have a healthy microbiome and you supplement with probiotics, it's a good idea to feed those guys. And for whatever reason, I take the best shits on earth when I have Happy Hippo Kratom. My dumps are incredible. And I can tell that my microbiome loves it. And I even did a test with Dr. Nathan Riley, comprehensive stool analysis, and Genova Diagnostics was blown away by how good my microbiome looked. And he said, well, you eat kind of more, you know, heavier meats and things like that, Heidi. And I said, it's the kratom, for sure. That's the only other thing. It's the main plant source that I get in my body. And it made sense. So I found out about kratom years ago through friends in the strength game as something that really paired well for people who have put their body through the ringer. If you're like me, you got a lot of miles on your car, and there's a lot of ticky-tack old things to work through on a daily basis, and this kind of quiets the noise around all that. There's also a euphoric effect where I just feel better, but at the same time, I don't lose focus. I don't lose my ability to move in the world with excellent hand-eye coordination. And if you think about anything else that might have a euphoric effect, and I can't name names here, but compare it to anything else that makes you feel good, most of those things come at the cost of losing hand-eye coordination. So this is one thing that's incredible about Happy Hippo Kratom, is that you can actually keep all of your fine motor skills while working with this stuff. And now it's not universal. It's going to be particular to the stuff that you're working with. There are a wide variety of strains and products and extracts that you can get from this company. So really, it's about running the N equals one experiment and seeing what's going to work best for me in what situation. One of the prompts from this read is, you know, talk about how you use it and what do you use it for. Pre-workout, it's absolutely incredible. Pre-run, absolutely incredible. Pre-yoga, I find it to be pre-yoga and stretching and mobility, incredible because it increases the mind-muscle connection, as Arnold used to talk about. I can breathe into the space and my body responds and opens and my mobility has improved tremendously. And even though it's not getting rid of some of the signals from my body where there's an old injury or an old thing to work through, it allows me to work with that and to with my own encouragement and thoughtfulness and breath, start to engage and open that up in a way that would normally just stay locked if I wasn't working with Kratom. So consider that. Consider the fact that if you have a runner's high or some type of benefit from running, you could have that while lifting weights. You could have that right in your first mile while running and even get it better as you enter mile two and above. This stuff is incredible. It has been used for centuries, if not thousands of years, by locals in Southeast Asia to bust their ass. People who work sun up to sundown in rice fields, people who had a grind. This is one of the ways you can grind and get through that and feel happy about it. I absolutely love this stuff. Personally, love the red strains. The yellow Meng Da is also really cool. Happy Hippo. But find out for yourself which one you like best. Go to happyhippo.com/KKP and remember to use code KKP for 15% off everything in the entire store. All right, without further ado, my brother, Mark Gaffney, is back as David J. Temple, speaking on behalf of Dr. Zach Stein and Ken Wilber and all those that contribute to this wonderful manuscript, First Principles and First Values. Let's do it. I got the book in hand, First Principles and First Values. This is what's nice about this is it gives us a small break from the 12 Phases of Eros, the series we've been putting together that you've been so graciously giving to the world via my podcast, and I've been the first recipient of the good news and the good word, so I really appreciate that. And you and a small amount of others writing as David J. Temple are putting together a series of books, this of course being the first. So break this down. First break down David J. Temple, if you will, and then break down what this book's all about.
So it's great to be with you, Kyle. And yes, I have the book here also. It's First Principles and First Values. And I want to say tenderly, you know, and gently, you know, and this is not about, I'm just to say the obvious. This is the opposite of book sales. This is read this book slowly. And this is an absolute commitment. You will live in a different world afterwards. So it's a book which is not, it's not a quick fix. It's short, super short. It's written almost in a bullet point style, you know, terse, epigrammatic, not long essays, but it's you have to read it sentence by sentence. You skip two paragraphs, and it's actually a laying out. I wrote the book, the first draft of the book about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. My co-authors in the book are Ken Wilber and Zach Stein. And we're coming together to be, right, Zach and I joined by Ken. Ken was a co-founder of the center, the think tank. And Zach is the co-president of the think tank. Zach and I have been studying for some 12 years in deep dive Holy of Holies. And he's a wonderful man and thinker and, you know, holder of the lineage. The reason we chose Kyle David J. Temple is because in this moment, in which we're in a time between worlds, right? We're in a time between stories where we literally could experience either the death of humanity or the death of our humanity. We have one critical response, which has to underlie all other responses, which can actually carry us through, which is to tell a new story, but not a new story in the postmodern sense. Let's declare a new story, but to tell a new story of value, meaning to aggregate all of the deepest insights of the traditional period across all realms of knowledge, all of the validated insights of the modern period, all of the validated insights of postmodernity, weave them together into a new story of value. And so, and that story of value, we have to be able to tell to 50 dentists, truck drivers, nursery school teachers, professors, gardeners in China, in Outer Mongolia, in Montana, right, in Sweden, in Zimbabwe, which has been renamed, right, in New Zealand, right, et cetera, right, on every continent in the world. So there's actually a shared grammar of value as a context for our diversity. So I want to be clear about this, not to homogenize us, not to create some oppressive world government, but actually the realization that there is no local anymore, that we're actually facing global challenges, and global challenges require global coordination, and global coordination requires global resonance. We have to resonate with each other. We have to be able to do shared sense making. We have to be able to have a conversation. We don't have to agree on values. We have to agree on value. And I want to make that distinction. It's not about, am I in favor of this set of values or that set of values? That's already an interesting and fascinating and beautiful conversation. It's actually about, are we together in the field of value? And to be together in the field of value means that value is backed by the universe. Meaning, value is not just a social contrivance. It's not just a social construct. It's not just, as my colleague from Israel, Yuval Harari, says, a fiction, a figment of our imagination, a social construct. No, it's actually a quality of the universe that evolves. It's not a static quality. So love is a value of the universe. You know, I was reading last night, there's a lovely, I'm sure he's a lovely man. I don't know him, but a guy named Jonathan Haidt. And Jonathan, if you're watching, with total delight. So I was vaguely aware of his work, but just for whatever reason, in the last couple of nights, I was looking at it because it's related to some future writing. And so I was looking at a book of his called, I happen to have here, The Righteous Mind, and another book called The Anxious Generation, and his first book called The Happiness Hypothesis. And, you know, he's doing something about kind of moral values and how to kind of, you know, move forward on a number of levels, and including the hijacking of attention. And he's doing good work. And it doesn't work because, so I'm reading last night, you know, Jonathan's book, The Happiness Hypothesis, and he's kind of very into positive psychology. And he's very clear. He says, I'm going to use words like the sacred, even though the sacred doesn't exist. And I'm going to talk about love, right? And I'm going to cite attachment theory and mating theory and nurture theory, right? You know, I know the literature, but I understand that love's not actually a real quality of cosmos, which has in it an ought, right? Value means there's an ought. There's something that needs to be done. And when I do that, I participate in the field of value, which is reality. That's what value means. Value means it matters. And it matters ultimately. Value means that reality is not just matter. Reality is what matters. And it's the single, literally the single pivot upon which civilization will either collapse, right? Meaning potential extinction, potential death of humanity or our humanity, based on really the best and most rigorous analysis, or civilization can actually rise. We can actually create the most true, good, and beautiful world that we could ever imagine. But the pivot question, right? The, you know, Rilke called it the pivoting point. You know, it's that upon which everything rests is value real? And value is real means that some things are better than other things. Now, that's a frightening thing for some people to say. So I was talking to someone the other day, right, who just, you know, kind of out of the blue, was kind of a surprise, you know, moment. And this person starts talking a language, which I realized that this person has completely rejected the notion of there being a field of value, and that the reason they were talking to me was to kind of attack the position that value is real. So I asked this person, so just tell me, Hitler's gas chambers, good or bad? Right? And this person, right, a sophisticated, cultured, a well-known, you know, relatively podcaster, refused to say the gas chambers were bad. And it's like, wow. I mean, but it's hard to get. You would think that's kind of obvious, right? Well, it's not. Right? In other words, if I can't establish that reality is coded with value, and value, what does value mean? It means one, my personhood matters. My personhood is a value. Two, my uniqueness matters. My unique personhood matters. Three, my attention belongs to me. You know, four, right? I have some level of free will which can't be taken from me. Four, five, right? The unique eros of my life, my unique aliveness and the unique quality of my desire in the context of the whole needs to be protected and honored. You know, five, six, that actually creating intimate communion, or that, you know, intimacy is a value of cosmos, and intimacy means shared identity in the context of otherness, and that creating context for intimacy is a core value of cosmos, and in the intimate universe, leaving people out of the circle of intimacy is a fundamental violation because it's an intimate universe that seeks ever greater circles of intimacy. So I'm going to go from me and my circle, egocentric intimacy, and I want to go then to a wider circle, ethnocentric intimacy, right? The wider song. And then a third circle, right? World-centric intimacy. I care for every human being. And then an even wider circle, a cosmocentric intimacy. I care for the planet. I care for animals. I care for, so that intimacy is a value of cosmos. But if intimacy is not a value of cosmos, and eros is not a value of cosmos, and choice is not a value of cosmos, meaning my capacity to make decisions, and uniqueness is not a value of cosmos, and my attention is not a value of cosmos, which is the assumption, I want to be very clear, that's the assumption A of closed societies, China, right? Russia, the assumption is none of those values are real, but it's also the assumption that actually pervades the techplex, the immersive environment, right, of the web, which actually militates against, which is beginning to generate a planetary stack in an immersive environment that actually undermines our free will, that manipulates our attention, that makes the notion of free elections a joke, if you actually understand, right, how attention is manipulated, right, that actually shapes our desire invisibly through technologies of control that we're not even aware are happening. But why would you not do that? You would not do that if value was real. Right. So whether we're talking about the Western versions of a kind of benign or covert totalitarianism, or we're talking about more overt versions of totalitarianism, they're both based on a premise, value is not real. Now, we can't organize a response to that. We can't create the new world. We assume, let me say it a little bit differently, we assume that human rights are going to live forever. We think human rights, of course, everyone has human rights. Human rights are 300 years old, 400 years old. That's it. They're a blip in history. They will be gone unless we assert, what are human rights rooted in? Human rights are rooted in value. That which is a value, I have a right to. Like, wow, that's like a big deal, right? If freedom is a value, I have a right to freedom. Right? If attention is a value, I have a right to my attention, right? Right? If my personhood is a value, then the defacing of my personhood, turning me into a number, right, instead of my personhood, right, needs to be protected. So it's only if there's a field of value, without that, nothing's protected. I'm going to give you just two examples. Suicide and sex. Let's do those two. Why not? You would think, who would commit suicide? Well, actually, you know, there's actually a growing movement, Holland, for example, in which assisted euthanasia for people who are not in crisis. I want to be clear about that. Not this an extreme crisis situation, either kind of a radical, painful moment of disease or old age, or, you know, unimaginably painful psychosis, right? There's a number of scenarios in which the moral conversation around assisted euthanasia begins. And it's a complex conversation. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about assisted euthanasia, meaning assisted suicide, as an option. You've got a bunch of options. You can do a career, or you can just quit. And so there was recently an essay about the growing of assisted euthanasia in Holland in non-crisis structures. Because actually, Brother Kyle, life's a big effort. And unless life is an intrinsic value, it's not the result of a pointless cosmos. It's not a random accident. Right? Life is not a tale told by an idiot full of sounds and furies signifying nothing. Shakespeare and Macbeth. And then Faulkner names his book in early existentialism, The Sound and the Fury. No, it's not a tale told by an idiot. It's not full of sounds and furies signifying nothing, which just has empty postmodern signifiers. No, actually, life is infinitely significant. We have a yearning for significance, and our significance is rooted in value. Value means there's not just matter. It means it matters. It means I matter because I'm a unique incarnation of value. And so we need to identify what is value, A, but not, now stay close, brother, okay, not pre-modern value owned by one religion that says, we got the value, you don't, you've got to accept our particular version of it. No, not. That's the pre-modern ethnocentric hijacking of value. Number one. No, that's off. That's wrong. Not the claim of all of the traditional world that values are preordained and eternal. They never change. Right? This is what love means, and it's never going to mean anything else. No, love is real and it evolves. So there's what I might call an evolving parentalism. There's a Tao, and the Tao, that ancient term from Taoism, the way I like to translate the Tao, and it's a precise translation, the Tao is the field of value. Right? Kyle and Mark live together in the field of value. Now we can beautifully argue in great paradox about how we're going to understand the field of value, but we won't polarize. That won't create polarization because we're both together in the field of value. And the shared field of value is a context for our diversity. It's not a homogenization, and we might interpret values differently, but we won't polarize because we're both in the field of value. And if there's no field of value, then essentially the world collapses, right? We can't actually create coherence. And if we can't create coherence, right, then we develop a global intimacy disorder and we have no capacity to create the global coordination to respond to global challenges. And at its core, the global intimacy disorder is based on the incapacity to articulate a shared grammar of value. So what we're doing in this book, right, in First Principles and First Values, is to actually tell the story of value. Now, you'll say to me, why does that matter? No, because there's no reason, unless life's of value, and it's not a given that life's of value. Or take sex. Take sex. The amount of sex happening in the world is going way down. Across closed and open societies in the last 10 years, there's less and less and less sex happening. Why? Well, so people say, you know, high-speed internet porn, fair. You know, AIDS, you know, a couple few decades back, but, you know, kind of fear, fair. You know, Me Too. Right? In other words, like, that's complicated, right? What does consent mean? Fair. So there's obviously, it's a multifactorial story, but there's something much deeper. And it's kind of shocking. It's that great sex with the right person should be had is a value of cosmos. Sex is a value, right? We took it as a given growing up, Kyle. Great sex with the right person in the right place and the right time, right? That's a great value. That is no longer true, right? For the enormous, enormous swath of the emerging populations, youth, men and women, right? And the sex is going down most in the younger 18 to 24 and the next 24 to 30. And it's not older people. Older people have this memory. Oh, that's a value. the failure to launch. Well, what's the root of the failure to launch? Because the value of creativity, the value of efforting, the value of transformation, those are values. Right? Why would I transform? Let me just stay the way I am. But transformation is a huge effort. It's a lifetime, right, of challenge and agony and ecstasy and holy and broken hallelujahs. Why launch? Unless launching is a value, right? In other words, if we deconstruct the field of value, we have deconstructed reality, and that is what we've done. What modernity did was deconstruct the field of value. Modernity did that in a hidden way, which we describe in the book. And then that hidden deconstruction of the field of value, which David Hume championed, explodes in postmodernity. And then when a figure, right, like Yuval Harari says that value is but fiction, but figment of our imagination, but social construct. And when Yuval goes on to say that there's no essential difference between a kid from England, right, who goes to slaughter Moors, to slaughter Muslims in the 13th century, and then from the same neighborhood in England, a kid from the same area, right, but this time aroused not by his bad priest, but by his good social worker, goes to work for Amnesty International, right, 7 centuries later. And Harari writes, Homo Deus, there's no essential difference in value between those two stories of value. And they're the same, just stories made up, figments of our imagination. That's chapter 2 in Sapiens. I'm putting the two texts together. Figments of our imagination, social constructs and fictions. Wow. Like, wow. Right? And then, you know, and paradoxically, you know, then Yuval writes an entire chapter that free will doesn't exist. There is no free will. Because, of course, forget about what I think is bad philosophy. Let's just bracket that for a second, right? But in Yuval's world, there's no value, and freedom's not a value, right? And so all he can see is materialist antecedent causation, and there's obviously, you know, a lot of literature supporting that. But actually, much more deeply, there's actually an experience that we have that's irreducible, that's happening, you know, even in our conversation right now. And Habermas pointed to this. He said, you know, Kyle and Mark can't have a conversation unless they experience some degree of freedom in that conversation. We've decided to talk. So yes, our friend Aubrey introduced us, and yes, we're interested. There's a whole series of antecedent causations, but underneath all of that, there's some quality of freedom in our talking, which is our joy. We don't feel like puppets. We have a direct experience of some degree of freedom. So if I don't value that, I don't protect it. And then we're in tyranny. And from tyranny, right, devolves to the most abject versions of totalitarianism. And you get every manner of brutality and every manner of evil and every manner of despair. And so we need not the old religion that claims value is mine, not a postmodern deconstruction, there is no value. We need to answer the attacks on value theory. And anyone who's listening, oh, that's too intellectual, I can't do that. Yes, you can. Actually, read slowly, carefully. You actually have to understand, why was value theory attacked? Why are those attacks partially right? How do we respond to them? But it's not a lost intellectual. It's actually simple. You'll get it. It's simple. It's direct. And then let's rearticulate the field of value and begin to realize value is real. And so we actually list in the book, brother, 18 first principles and first values of cosmos. And these are the plot lines of cosmos. These are the actual plot lines of cosmos. And I live in the field of value. So let's say it this way. 3 great questions. Who am I? Who are we? Where am I? Where are we? What ought I do? Those questions are all only answerable in one way. Where am I? I'm in the field of value. And the field of value is not abstract. It's the field of what we call in this book, Eros value. Because the primary value of reality is Eros. It's the movement of radical aliveness towards ever deeper contact and ever greater wholeness. But that movement of Eros is a value of cosmos. It's not an accident. It's a value. And I'll give you a good example. In evolutionary psychology, all over the place, which is an important discipline, but one that's often so thin, it'll say, oh, why do women select for men that are musical or kind? They say, that's not because it's a value. It's because it helps survival. It's a survival factor. But they're forgetting something. Survival is a value. Survival's not a given. Survival means there's a telos, there's a value. What's the value? Life. And I'm willing to turn over reality upside down and right side up in order to survive, meaning not just life is a value, my life's a value, which means my irreducibly unique life is a value. That's inherent in cosmos. So what evolutionary psychology does is it pretends like there's no value and calls it survival, as if survival was like some built-in given in the mechanical manual. That's nonsense. So I need to actually realize more life, more creativity, more uniqueness, more care, more kindness, more depth, more goodness, more truth, more beauty, more transformation. These are first principles and first values of cosmos. We actually offer an interior science equation for each of them. But what we do most in the books, we try and lay out this field of Eros value. It's rapid fire bullet points. And without that, I actually lose access to the plot lines of my own life. Because where are we? We live in the field of Eros value. Who am I? I'm a unique incarnation of the field of Eros value. So I don't only live in the field of Eros value. The field of Eros value lives in me. And then what ought I do? I ought commit the unique, outrageous acts of Eros value that are mine to do. And I am an expression of Eros value, right? I am, if we would say it in spiritual terms, I'm God's verb. But I'm not a noun, I'm a verb. But I'm God's verb. But I'm God's dangling modifier. Right? And I am poised by the unique context of my life on the abyss of darkness with the capacity to say, let there be light that no one else that ever was, is, or will be has except for me. And the measure of my life, and my life is measured, meaning I'm held to account because I count. Not because there's some evil, sinister force that, you know, wants to hold me accountable for masturbating when I was, you know, 17. That's not what we mean by accountability. Accountability means my life matters. It's not just matter. My life matters and I'm accountable. I count because I'm a unique incarnation of value and I have a value contribution, an Eros value contribution to make to reality, which is why I was born. And it might be in my own self-transformation. It might be in my own, the poetry of my life. But every single person has a song to sing, right? A poem to write, a way of laughing, loving, being, which has unique value in the world. And the invitation of my life is not to be an imposter, right? Is to live that unique value, to live your story of value. Right? And that's what this book is, a step to that. And the first step is I have to know what is value and how do I ground myself in the field of value and what are the plot lines of cosmos? In all of these plot lines, we're not making a dogmatic claim. They're self-evident. And we wrote the book as David J. Temple. And this is a long way now where, as we complete, we can answer the first question because it's not about owning it. It's not an ownership move. This is not a, let's do a win-lose metric author, you know, major intellectual move. That's not the move. We're in a time between worlds and a time between stories like we were in the Renaissance. We're facing metacrisis of unimaginable proportion. We have to be Da Vinci together. It's not just about one unique self. It's about being a unique self symphony together. And so we came together at the center to try and do what they did in Florence, right? To, in this time between stories, to actually tell a new story of value, but not one that's made up. You know, there was a poet that wrote, a poetess actually who wrote, you know, the world's not made up of atoms, it's made up of stories. That's not quite true. The world is atoms and stories, but atoms are also stories, right? An atom is actually a story of value. It's a story of attraction, allurement, and desire to come together. And story evolves all the way up the evolutionary chain. So the invitation of this book is live your story. Live your story of value, but do it at an exponentially higher level than you ever thought you could. Don't give up the field and say, oh, it's them. They're going to be the thinkers. And I'm doing my thing. Tell me something about Atlantis. Blessings to Atlantis. Right? Yeah, blessings to Atlantis. I get you're a Palladian. Blessings to being a Palladian. Right? Now, I mean, I want to just bless and honor that because I think that we do have an extraterrestrial cosmos. And we do have a galactic cosmos, and those things are unbelievably important, and we need to bring them to bear in the story. But I can't be focusing on being a Palladian, right, while I'm dissociated from what's the field of value, right? Because the reason the universe is going to look towards planet Earth is because we have something to offer, right, in the value equation of the cosmos, right? We're moving into a galactic world, and value is cosmic. Value is the shared grammar, not of planet Earth, but of cosmos. And so we need to clarify here on planet Earth the most clarified vision of value for each of us personally. And when I lose access to the field of value alive in me, no matter how successful I become, my sex stops working, my relationship stops working, my joy stops working, because joy is aroused by value, right? Will is aroused by value, right? So it's a big invitation. And I just, if I can, Kyle, it's just real to ask everyone, really get the book and forget about me, forget about Zach, forget about Ken. This is for you. And this is for the unique self symphony, and read it carefully. Trust yourself. Trust your mind. Trust your heart. It's short. But don't read it for a quick fix, right? This is not a quick hit of cocaine. This is kind of, it's a slow burning medicine that you kind of take. It's intense, step by step. And when you finish it, just stay in it, simmer in it. And I can promise this, it'll transfigure you for life. And then come back to us and offer us your insight, your unique expression of value. Let's do this together. Let's take the next steps together. And let's join the revolution. Let's join the unique self symphony. Let's actually become together the new story of value, not just to be the storytellers, to actually be the new story together. The first principles and first values. I'm so delighted. Here's a picture of the book for those of you who are looking. Right, it's called First Principles and First Values. It's on Amazon. And oh my God, let's do this. Thank you.
Thank you, brother. Thank you. I'm so stoked. And you did so good there. I know we don't have a ton of time left, but I wanted to talk to you for a minute on please, the importance of what you're laying out. You know, we've talked about Yuval Noah Harari and you know, his master Klaus Schwab, who was an understudy of Henry Kissinger, and the long list of folks that seem to be taking, you know, that seem to have an eye for taking out our humanity. And you know, in the last 4 years, I didn't really panic about the pandemic. I did panic about the potential loss of our humanity, and seeing that there has been a long-term play towards that, you know, a long-term play to move to a new world order, a one-world government. And I think it's absolutely critical in this First Principles and First Values book, because it reminds me of this is how we come to the shared horizon, right? When we talk wholemate, which, you know, you've used in many different ways, but not just amongst lovers, roommate, soulmate, wholemate, it takes us having a shared understanding of everything that we're doing in order to get arm in arm and see the future and see what we're going to do going forward. And I think it's just a beautiful, beautiful short book on how we come into that wholemateness together.
That's gorgeous, Kyle. And you know, you just aroused it in such a beautiful way. The reason, see, there's this big move to kind of, and you see it around the web, there's this demonization of the one world people, you know, whether it's Yuval or Schwab, you know, et cetera. You know, I've read a lot of the World Economic Forum stuff, but let me bracket that for a second. But let me just talk about Yuval for a second. I'm sure Yuval's a beautiful guy, and I'd love to have him for dinner. And I'm sure we'll meet at some point, and we've overlapped. My son was in his class at Hebrew U. You know, we lived in proximate to each other in Israel for a period of time. And so this is not about the demonization of a guy at all. Yuval's making the only move he can make. And, you know, I'll give you another example of, if I can find it here. You know, another person who made the exact same move was B.F. Skinner, who was the behaviorist, you know, psychologist. And I'm completing a book now with Zach. Actually, it's going to be under David J. Temple, which is about, you know, Skinner's book Walden 2, which is his utopian novel that he writes in 1947, which is basically about how you turn the world into a controlled environment, which was called a Skinner's box. A Skinner's box is technically called an operant conditioning chamber, in which rats and pigeons are conditioned by levers, which create schedules of reinforcement that shape their desire without them knowing that it's happening. And Skinner wanted to know, how do you do that? Not at the level of the animal world. Skinner wanted to know, how do you do that at the level of the human world? But he didn't have, he writes at the end of his life, he said, I don't have the machines and methods to do it. So he does the beginning, but he can't quite get there because he doesn't have the machines and methods. Along comes data science in places like the MIT Media Lab and the first waves of AI and machine intelligence that's aligned with asymmetric power to human beings to shape their desire and to actually undermine our humanity. And the reason we can undermine our humanity is because no one knows what our humanity is. Until our humanity is challenged, we don't have to assert what does it mean to be a human being. It's kind of a given. And so that's why first principles and first values are so important. And that's if I don't assert that being a human being means the irreducible dignity of my uniqueness, the irreducible dignity of my capacity for intimate communion, right? The irreducible dignity of my drive towards transformation and deepening in depth, the irreducible dignity of my freedom, of some dimension of freedom. If we don't actually affirm those, not just as human social constructs, there's not just made up contrived values as, let's say, Pentland writes in his book, Social Physics, but even the critics of the techplex, they don't know how to find value because they're postmodern. So they critique the techplex for doing these terrible things, but they have no basis in which to ground the critique. So therefore, they can't arouse the will for action because will is only aroused by value. And we're affirming that these values are grounded in cosmos, that they go almost all the way down and all the way up the evolutionary chain. And of course, they evolve. So love, right, the field of Eros, expresses itself in one way in the animal world and one way in the subatomic world and a different way between Kyle and his partner and in our friendship. But it's the same movement of separate parts wanting to have deeper contact and form larger wholes, which means more value and more depth and more kindness. And as we said in a different context, the only way we can object to evil, because evil is a violation of the field of value. And if there's no field of value, then there's no evil. Right? I mean, it's so profound. And so Yuval, it's not that, oh, Yuval's some demonic, right? Not at all. I'm sure he's a great guy, right? And a lovely guy to have over for dinner. And, you know, when I'm asked about this, people get always quite upset with me. Goffney must be some, you know, secret agent of the World Economic Forum because he refuses to demonize Yuval. Well, fuck that, right? Right? But what Yuval's saying is the same thing Skinner was saying. Yuval is saying, I'm a materialist. And he's a dogmatic materialist, not for particularly good reasons. Yuval's a good storyteller in history and quite a poor philosopher, right? But Yuval's saying there's no value and we're threatened by existential risk and we're going to get fucked. So okay. So Yuval becomes paradoxically both a critic and a shill, you know, for the techplex. And he adopts this very subtle position. He kind of critiques and yet endorses at the same time. And Klaus Schwab, you know, when he talks about kind of resetting the world order, right, it's not per se, it's often the case that the first generation of social engineers actually remembers value. But by the second generation and the third, it's gone. You know, C.S. Lewis, and maybe we will conclude with this, at least on my side, C.S. Lewis writes this, you know, the great Oxford Don, who I disagree with a lot about, right? He kind of was trying to advance a certain kind of Christianity, but he got the field of value. So C.S. Lewis writes in 1943, you know, about 4 years before Skinner's Walden II was published, he writes a book called, and I'm showing a book, and I know most people are actually listening, so why am I showing that? Okay. I was showing the book Walden II, Skinner's utopian novel. You know, Lewis writes a little short book called The Abolition of Man. And he describes the omnicompetent scientific methods of, and he doesn't use Skinner's name, but he's clearly talking about Skinner, right? That will actually emerge in which a few men will control all men. And he says in the first generation, they'll still be good guys. They're going to be doing their best to respond to existential risk, a world run amok with no orienting value and no potential for coherence other than invisible levers of control. Because there's no other way to create coherence. But actually, the response to an oppressive and dominating world government is a shared grammar of value. And it's what actually can cohere us is actually we're living in a shared story of value, again, as a context for our diversity, right? So every religion should stand and all different forms of geographical loyalty in countries. It's all good. It's a beautiful, unique self-symphony, but the unique self-symphony is music underneath. There's a shared score of music as a context for our diversity. So when we meet around the world, we actually get our life's a value, uniqueness is a value, kindness is a value, personhood's a value, right? And we honor those values. Right? And so I don't think, and I want to, you know, and I apologize for this, you know, I don't think it can happen without first principles and first values. And I think, you know, and I avoided, brother, writing, quote unquote, like a bunch of bestseller books in order to write this. Because a bestseller book's here today and gone tomorrow. It's not, I mean, and blessings to all the people writing, you know, those kinds of books, and they're valuable and blessings to them. So I don't want in any way deride anyone's, you know, beautiful energy. But what we need is a source code evolution, right? And that's what this book is trying to do. So I'm just really inviting everyone to trust yourself, trust your capacity to read, trust your capacity to go deep, trust your capacity to, right, understand that without value, nothing moves. And don't try and think, how does this give me a great orgasm tomorrow? Actually, it's not going to do that. It's going to do something much deeper. It's going to actually ground you in the field of desire for the next 50 years. And everything flows from that. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, brother. Cha. I love you, brother.
Cha.